I'd like to introduce our first speaker today, General Todd Rokita. Todd Rokita was elected as Indiana's Attorney General on November 3, 2020, having earned the highest number of votes of any state office holder in Indiana history. As Indiana's Chief Legal Officer, Todd has pledged to fight to protect Hoosiers from crime, fight lawlessness in our streets, uphold the rule of law, support our men and women in law enforcement, and protect our constitutional rights. An experienced attorney, seasoned business executive, and proven public servant, Todd has spent his career putting Hoosiers first. Todd practiced law for several years before entering public service, representing the interests of Indiana businesses and individuals in state and federal courts. As a voice for Indiana in Congress, Todd served as vice chairman of the nation's budget committee. With a passion for improving the quality of our children's educational outcomes and our nation's healthcare system, as apropos here, Todd also served as a subcommittee chairman on the only House committee of jurisdiction over education and employee healthcare. Todd is a multiple year recipient of NFIB's Guardian of Small Business Award. Todd also has a 100% record from the National Right to Life, and Todd has earned the strongest scores for defending our Second Amendment constitutional freedoms and religious liberty. Todd was raised in Munster, Indiana, up north. He earned his undergraduate degree from Wabash and received his law degree from Robert H. McKinney School of Law at the Indiana University School of Law. Todd and his wife, Kathy, a successful partner in a CPA firm, have two sons, Ryan and Teddy. Please welcome General Rokita.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate that. I asked Brian to mention the highest number of votes in an election in Indiana history because after being in office for about 2 weeks, I realized this probably would never happen again. It's been an amazing office to work for the people of Indiana through like nothing I've ever experienced before. And part of that, and I'll mention a couple of them later, is are the great people that we get, that I get to work with. Not part of my remarks, but since Brian reminds me, I'm just going to say it while I have it top of mind. I honestly, when I was running for the office of Indiana Attorney General, expected the worst, in a sense, especially if I'd won and I'd gotten in office, about what I would find. And if you'd give me some grace, you'd realize that, you know, I was in Congress for 8 years, and I was dealing with the federal bureaucracy, right? And of course, the Federal Society members would know, you know, really what that means, how the legislature, our Congress, over decades, really, have ceded their lawmaking authority to these unelected people through regulation. And hopefully I'll get to a story in more detail about how I learned that. But the point of the matter here is that they weren't returning the phone calls of congressmen, right? Certainly, I would doubt practicing attorneys. And after they check their database, certainly not you, being members of the Federal Society. So here, when I was learning about the office, 400 people, 200 attorneys, 20,000 cases a year. You can imagine what was thinking I was going to inherit here. And I couldn't have been more wrong. I am known, depending on what Google searches you do, to be firm but fair, to work diligently, my word, into the night, sending emails out at all times. But quickly, when I got into office, I was the one getting emails at 11 o'clock at night from true public servants who were serving with servants' hearts, who could be making a lot more money in other places for sure. But had decided to work for the people of the state of Indiana, and were doing it well. I mean, world-class briefs. I was quickly starting to see excellent arguments, There's excellent people all around. And so my hat's off to them, who will be represented by our Solicitor General today and our Director of Policy, Tom Fisher and Corrine Youngs, respectively. And then we have other great servants here, too, that are listening. And some I noticed some past employees as well. It's an honor to speak at this event. No organization, in my opinion, in modern America has done more to preserve our constitutional liberties than this Federalist Society. When President Trump promised to appoint judges to the federal bench who revere the Constitution, it was the Federalist Society, of course, who famously was turned to by him for guidance in evaluating the prospective nominees. And obviously, we're most familiar with the top three, right? Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, who all came from the Federalist Society list. But President Trump also appointed a total of 226 judges, including 54 federal appellate judges to serve on the nation's 13 federal courts, appeals courts. So that's an impressive legacy right there, and one which the Federalist Society played a huge, huge role. And I like to think that the Federalist Society is built in part on good old-fashioned Hoosier common sense. Those of you who are from out of state, welcome, first of all. And secondly, we call it Hoosier common sense. One of the Federalist Society founders, after all, grew up in Kendallville, Indiana, from the age of five. And after helping found the Federalist Society, David McIntosh went on to serve 6 years representing Indiana's second congressional district. And of course, the original faculty advisor to the Federalist Society was no less a luminary than the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And this was a judge who changed my life in a significant way. I can't say that we were friends. I can't say that I ever had the opportunity to clerk for him, although my first clerkship law firm is represented here, and my mentor, my very first mentor, is represented here, Ross Stovall. I appreciate everything he's done. But Antonin Scalia was someone who I had a chance to meet several times in Congress, and I'm not even sure why he reached out to me. I'm sure it was because he read something dumb I said in the paper at some point. Yeah, it happens. And actually, I kind of do know why. It was, for those of you from Illinois, you may know Peter Roskam. There's a good man, not an attorney, but a former member of Congress, a fella who one day just frankly got super duper pissed off. He was a math teacher. He ran for Congress. And I don't know how it came to be, but he came up to me one day on the floor of the House of Representatives and said, "Antonin Scalia wants to have dinner with you." Now, usually when Italians asked me to dinner at the back room of an Italian restaurant, which is where he wanted to meet me, I don't go. It's just a personal thing. But I thought, well, you know, how could Antonin Scalia, how bad can this be? I've been reading him for years. I absolutely adore him. So I went. And we had a very nice dinner. There were just one or two other congressmen there. And it was in my first term. And the Supreme Court had just upheld the constitutionality of what's been come to not be known as Obamacare. And that's why I ran for Congress in large part. I was throwing things at the TV, and my wife wanted me out of the house, and so we ran. That's how that happened. And so I was polite. We had a nice dinner. He called for questions amongst this, again, group of three. I immediately shot forward. "Justice, please, we really need your help. You certainly understand that even though we had just come in, remember, we're the class that deposed Nancy Pelosi, the Tea Party class. We're still only one third of the decision when you consider the Senate, when you consider, or maybe one fourth of the decision, when you consider the Senate, when you consider the president, when we consider the court. And I can't understand why you upheld Obamacare as a simple tax, when absolutely it's not an enumerated power, when absolutely the federal government has no right to fine somebody for not purchasing health care insurance. You remember this. And he paused. I said, we need your help. We really do. We can't afford to not win this, to keep losing these cases. And he paused and he said, you think you know your Constitution? I said, yeah, I think I do. You don't know what you're talking about. He said, if you knew your Constitution, then you would know that the court, in this sense, is the weakest branch of government. I said, in what sense? In the sense that you are the lawmaker. You have the power. It's why you're discussed first. You are the direct representative of the people. And you have, you being decades of congressman, you have ceded your precious authority under the Constitution to unelected people who are now regulating all of us. Do not come to me to bail you out. Oh. But we learn from it. And without, it's a subject of a different speech, I won't bore you any longer with it, but not only a great man, but he, I would hope in a very, very small way, I've honored his legacy by the bills we went on to pass. The Every Child Succeeds Act that replaced the terrible Bush, Kennedy-led No Child Left Behind was done with what we call negotiated rulemaking. So the Department of Education was not allowed to do what Scalia had warned about, but they had to negotiate and work with stakeholders to collaborate and come up with rules. Still, that wasn't good enough for me. I also passed an FAA bill where, when the FAA came out and said, we don't have to put the rules to this bill out for public comment, I was very concerned. Because one of the things Scalia had said, you do not write your rules with enough specificity. You do not write your laws with enough specificity. That's what he meant by letting the bureaucrats take over. You guys are lazy. You cede this authority by not writing the law specific enough. So I wrote this FAA bill really specific. But when the FAA came and said, we're not even going to put these rules out for public comment, I was pretty scared. I kept reading, and it said, we found that this bill, which was the basic med bill for any of those who follow aviation, we find that this bill was written so specific that the rules simply, literally, repeat the law. So I don't even know why they wrote a rule in the first, but they felt like they had to justify themselves. But it actually was a repeat of the law. So, Justice Scalia, some have listened to you. Many more need to listen to you. The Federalist Society's Statement of Purpose mentions several important principles, as you no doubt know, but one I would like to highlight today is the principle that, quote, the state exists to preserve freedom, unquote. And that principle is foundational not only to the Federalist Society, but indeed American liberty. And it is very much connected to the topic you'll be focusing on today. And that topic, education, is, of course, as I've already alluded to, near and dear to my heart. During my time in Congress, I chaired the Committee on Early Childhood, Elementary, and Secondary Education. And over the years, I've met with countless parents, teachers, administrators. I've been to 100 schools, not only in Indiana, but across the country. I've gotten to the point where I can tell within 2 minutes if, upon entering a school building, whether or not that institution exists for the adults in the building or for the kids in the building. And like I said, Tom Fisher and Corinne Young's we'll be filling you in on different aspects of what we're doing in the Indiana Attorney General's office today, which is pretty, some would say, outside the standard lane of an attorney general to focus on education so much. But in a sense, we all are these days, because the issues, whether it's the transanity that's coming through our classroom, or the parental choice, or so many other issues, or school choice, is ending up in the laps of your attorneys general. It starts with the fact that we need to affirm the principle that it's parents and not the government who have the first and primary, perhaps sole, responsibility to raise and educate their own children. And I say this in, try not to say it in a denigrating sense when I talk with teachers or about teachers, but frankly, or school administrators, but frankly, they are the hired help. They help parents do the parent's job. They are not supposed to supplant the parent in their minds, nor is it fair to make teachers be parents. And I'll always meet them at least halfway on that issue. Of course, those who yearn to keep control over children's education in the hands of government are quick to remind us that some parents are bad parents, and therefore they have to engage, they have to interfere, they have to intervene. And to this reality, I say the reason is a reason we must limit parents' rights. Of course, the government is not only justified but obligated to outlaw things like child abuse and neglect. And to that point, the government is not only justified but obligated to prevent anyone, even parents, from enabling minors under 18, for example, to alter their bodies through gender change medications or surgeries. That's probably not what the detractors meant. But the exceptions prove the rule. On the whole, it's always best to keep parents in charge, because our best chance for growing up successive, liberty-loving generations is a foundational family unit. That's much better than having government in charge and indoctrinating our kids. So the rights of parents to direct their own kids' education and upbringing are absolutely, I say, essential to a free republic. And this is a bit controversial. For those of you who are from Indiana, you know this. From those of you who are outside of Indiana, I will say, in terms of party politics, in terms of bringing this state back from the backwaters it was in, this thinking is about 15 years old now. The idea was to have a truce on social issues. And I agreed. I was in public office at the time. That made a lot of sense. It doesn't now. The problem with that is you can't have a one-sided truce, number one. A truce only works when both sides have the truce. The other side never stopped. That aside, the thinking was if you had a truce on the social issues, you stopped talking about them and you just focused on the economic issues, that's all government can and should do. Fair to a certain extent. And you're looking at, you're inside one of the proven products of that thinking. We did focus just on the economic issues, but now we live, because the other side didn't stop, in a situation where it's like the movie Hoosiers, that old saying from the movie Hoosiers, for those of you who are familiar with it. There's two kinds of crazy. There's the kind that runs around naked in the woods, and there's the kind that does the same thing in your living room. That second one you're forced to deal with. And now you're seeing this on your TV every night. We're forced to deal with this. And there are some, and here's the problem, and it may be one of you, maybe some of you, and let's have that discussion, that think we should still just focus on the quote-unquote economic issues. As if all this craziness is going to pass over our heads like some kind of biblical angel of death. No. The fact of the matter is this. these social issues really are economic ones at their root. And here's why. Let's prove the opposite of it first. Socialism abhors a family unit. Can't stand it, right? In socialism, your family is the government. It's your mom, it's your dad, it's your big brother. Meanwhile, proving the other side of it, free enterprise absolutely requires a strong foundational family unit in order to survive. And at the end of the day, Marxism and free enterprise are both economic constructs. Economic constructs. And so this brazen transanity, as I call it, these other things that we're scratching our heads, seeing on TV every night, are really attacks on that family unit. Because if you don't have a strong family, you don't have those values transferred down. You're not able to teach personal responsibility, which free enterprise absolutely requires in order to function. And you create that dependence that the Marxist and the chaos that that Marxist so sorely needs. So that's how I look at my day, every day when I come into the office and I see these lawsuits that we're defending. I see these lawsuits that we're starting. And that's the lens I look at it through. If you're ever scratching your head wondering why what's that Indiana Attorney General doing now and why, please remember these comments, and maybe that'll help explain what the Indianapolis Star refuses to grasp. But it's taken us in some pretty wide lane departures. We have a Parents' Bill of Rights that's now in its fifth edition. It's 81 pages. It's in question and answer format, but it's meant to empower parents to raise their children. I thought it was a great thing, not a terrible thing, when parents started going to school board meetings. It was telling me that they understood that their job was to raise their kids, not the schools. What I didn't want to have happen is what we saw happening in Virginia, where SROs were hauling these parents to jail. And so we came up with the first edition of the Parents' Bill of Rights. Here's what Indiana law does. Here's what it doesn't do. And we actually learned some things in that. For example, before the Parents' Bill of Rights, even though we thought it was with the case, it was not. You could appear at a school board meeting. It certainly was public. It had to be properly noticed. All those things were in there. But you had no right as a parent or taxpayer to speak at a school board meeting. You had no right to be recognized. And there were school districts all around the state who knew that and were not letting parents speak. So that Parents' Bill of Rights immediately led to a change in Indiana law. And that's just one example. It went on from there. The point is this, in closing, and consider this perhaps a call to action. You all have a tremendous sphere of influences. You're a member of the bar. Aside from the jokes and the snickers and the this and the that, people look up to us, people respect us, people expect us to know. And they may never approach you. This could be your neighbor, this could be the person at church, this could be the person on the bowling team, who knows? Whatever it is, we have to get out of our comfort zone. This group that we're with, that we're part of, is special. We all have busy lives. I will keep fighting. I look at it as something I'm paid to do. Paid very little, but paid to do. And we diligently do it. And I don't know how many politicians, Brian offended me. The first thing out of his mouth this morning was, "Oh, you're something about a politician and me." I said, "Well, that's pretty offensive." And I don't know how many politicians would ever say this at a microphone, but if you rely on me and Tom Fisher and Corrine Youngs to do this, I will guarantee you one thing. We will lose the republic. We the people means we the people. We can help lead the way, but it really has to be all of you. It has to be all of us. And that sphere of influence is something that you have. And again, it's just like your 13-year-old, like the one I have at home. He might pretend he's not listening to you, but he's hearing you. That's the same with your neighbor. That's the same with you, like I said, your fellow churchgoer, your fellow teammate, your fellow office worker. You have to have that uncomfortable conversation. You don't have to get into fisticuffs. You're not, as you all know, you're not going to persuade anyone by being nasty about it and by alienating people, but you have to push the issue. They know you are here today. They're waiting for the engagement. They see the bumper sticker on your car when they look over the fence. It's time for us to open our mouths effectively and use the God-given skills we've been given to save this republic. So as Benjamin Franklin said, as he came out of Independence Hall all those years ago, and that elderly but influential lady who came up to him and said, "Sir, what kind of government have you given us?" He, of course, famously replied, "Ma'am, you have a republic, comma, if you can keep it." In my view, what Antonin Scalia was about, what David McIntosh is about, what the Federalist Society is about, what we're about, is that if you can keep it. And we're the ones to do it. Thank you very much. Have a great conference.